Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Amity.
And I'm Laura. Let's get started. Here we go. Part three.
Okay.
Of Frankenstein.
Yeah, maybe to do just sort of a quick recap. I was talking with Ken this week and I was like, you probably actually say it more like Frankenstein, right?
Probably
more accurate. And it actually sounds cooler than Frankenstein. I might just refer to him as that. Frankenstein. Anyways, So his little brother had been killed. He's pretty sure it was the monster he created who killed his little brother. And then there's a girl who's blamed for the death and she's put to death because nobody can prove her innocent. And so he is just feeling absolutely just in hell. And he's like wandering through the hills of this place in, it's called Chimonie, is how I'm going to say it. I don't know. That's probably wrong, but it's very French. And he runs into the monster that he created. Basically, we find out that they haven't seen each other for about 2 years. And so the monster is going to catch him up on what has been happening for the past 2 years.
Yes. And what's interesting is, I want to bring this up, which I guess if people have listened and gotten this far, they probably already know, or maybe you're just listening and not reading. But I was working on our first episode today that we recorded, and we had said, this is a really hard read. It's not.
No. Once you get past the first part, it's not at all. It flows so well.
Yes.
Great story.
Yes. Yeah. So I just want, if anybody's afraid of it, because we said that, don't be, because it's not that hard. And it's totally accessible, understandable. Yeah. There's parts that are hard. Like you said, the beginning, I think, just keep reading them though. And just like, okay, I don't understand what's going on, but just keep going, because there are parts. I think the important parts of the story are easy to understand. So
yes,
I just thought that was kind of an interesting thought. As I was listening to us, I was like, oh no, people are going to think this is hard.
It's not. It's great.
Yeah. So we decided to quit early last week because we were going to do through chapter 11, but then that is where the monster story started. And so we thought that'd be really good to put all of the monster story in one episode. And I think that was a wise decision. He starts his story. I think this is when he just first leaves the apartment. He's cold. And so he took some clothes to wear, but it wasn't enough. He's outside and he's just freezing because he has nothing. So he's hungry. So he goes ahead and eats berries, which is interesting because later it talks about how he can sustain himself on berries. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to eat like we do, but he's also confused. So he's kind of understanding his senses more and more, like he's able to smell and taste and hear and see. At this point, he discovers a fire that some people had left behind. And so this is kind of an interesting little section where he kind of learns about fire, like how the wood needs to be dry and how he noticed that the people were using it to cook their food. Eventually he leaves that spot, but then he's like, I don't have a fire because somebody else had started that fire. So he didn't understand how to make it. Then he discovers snow and it's uncomfortable, which I thought was kind of an interesting little section there. He encounters a hut, and inside this hut is an old man who is making breakfast. The old man hears a noise. And then he screams and runs out. He ran across the fields with a speed of which his debilitated form hardly appeared capable. His appearance different from any I had ever before seen, and his flight somewhat surprised me. Then it talks about how he was, quote, enchanted by the hut because it's dry inside. I thought that was kind of an interesting concept. Like he's like, oh, well, there's this structure and inside there's no snow. And so everything is dry. So the man had left. So he eats the man's breakfast and then he falls asleep. And then around noon, he takes off again and he comes across a village with lots of huts this time. He's kind of enticed by the food that he sees the people eating inside. Well, first he sees that there's food in their gardens, and then he can see into their windows that they have food. He steps into one of the huts and the kids shriek and a woman faints and everyone in the village basically freaks out. It said, some fled, some attacked me until grievously bruised by stones and many other kinds of missile weapons. I escaped to the open country and fearfully took refuge in a low hovel, quite bare and making a wretched appearance after the palaces I had beheld in the village. So, or he finds a place that's not anywhere near the huts that he had seen earlier. Well, I called it a den. this place is unpleasant. There are chinks in the walls, so wind gets in. He can't stand up in there. There's no floor. Also, there is, so this hovel, is it, it's attached to a cottage?
Yeah, I'm guessing it's kind of like a lean-to or something, but they never use it. So
obviously.
Yeah. But that's kind of what I imagine is it's a lean-to. So something that's been built onto it.
Yeah.
But you enter it from the outside. And depending on lean-to, sometimes you could enter from the house. Sometimes you enter from the outside. But that's just what I'm picturing.
I thought it was kind of interesting, though, that, I mean, he stays there for a long time and they don't ever go in there or right. I don't know. That's kind of amazing. But so, yeah, there's this cottage that is attached to this hovel. The next morning, he kind of ventures over to the cottage that is connected to his little shack. He uses stones and wood to hide himself from them. And so that's when he decides he's going to stay there. It's like, this is a good place for me to stay. So what he finds in the cottage is there's a girl, and he watches this girl carry a pail on her head, and then she'll disappear and then come back with milk in it. He sees a boy, and he can see into the cottage. And in the cottage, it's a whitewashed room with not much furniture, and there's an old man in there. I mean, at this point, he's just watching these people, and he witnesses this sweet scene with the old man and the girl. The old man plays an instrument, and the girl is crying. He sees this girl kneel down at his feet, and he's crying. And it talks about how he can't bear these emotions that he's feeling by what he's watching.
I felt sensations of a peculiar and overpowering nature. It says they were a mixture of pain and pleasure, such as I had never before experienced, either from hunger or cold, warmth or food. And I withdrew from the window, unable to bear these emotions. First of all, it's brilliant writing because our author is able to really put herself into the place of somebody who has no idea about anything. He's, by all appearances, a grown man who is a baby. And it's kind of cool too, because you go, these are probably things that a baby would experience as they come into the world. And they're like, what am I feeling right now? They don't know what cold is. They don't know what too hot is. They don't know what hunger is. They don't know what is happening in their mouth when their teeth are trying to pop through, you know, but all these things to learn. And there's so much. And he has a lot more expectation on him because he appears to be a grown man, but he knows nothing, you know? So anyway, it's just kind of interesting.
He doesn't really know what he's feeling either, right?
No.
I think that's what kids think too. I mean, even our six-year-old, like I think a lot of times she doesn't know what she's feeling, and she's been here for 6 years and
right.
communicate. And, you know, tonight she's kind of being difficult. And I told my husband, I think she's getting sick. Like, she's kind of sniffling, and she kept saying, no, I have allergies. I'm like, no, I think she's getting sick. But I spelt the word sick because she gets upset when she hears it. And she goes, you just spell the F word. And I was like, when have I ever spelled the F word?
Why did that even come to your mind? That's really funny.
That was funny.
Well, it also makes me think of, like, whenever my kids, like all my six children, five out of the six, because the six isn't potty trained yet. The first few years after they've been potty trained, and it really is like the first few years, they will like randomly wake up in the middle of the night and just be sobbing and hysterical. And there's nothing. I'm like, I'm always initially like, oh my gosh, are they having a night terror? Like, what's going on? And like, try to give them hugs, try to calm them down. It's clear that they're like not really awake. They don't know what is going on. They have no idea what's going on. And then finally, I'll remember, because I have done it a million times, and I'll go put them on the potty. They just need to go potty. And then they're totally fine. But they don't, like, they're coming out of sleep, and it's like their body is trying to tell them something really needs to happen, but it can't happen while you're asleep.
And yeah, they're kind of awake, and they're like, I don't know, but something.
I don't know. I don't know what's
something.
On. Yeah, it's so funny.
He's just basically watched these three people in this cottage, and he kind of describes them, like the old man. I think, does it talk about him being blind in this one? I don't know, but the old man is blind.
I'm not sure if it says right in here.
And the boy, I think he realizes that they are his children, but I think they're pretty grown. And they're sad. That's the other thing, is he notices that they're sad. So we'll get the story about that later. But so the next, chapter 12, the next day he observes them more. This is where he finds out that the old man is blind. He says that the younger boy and the girl have respect and love for the old man, but they aren't always happy. He says they were not entirely happy. The young man and his companion often went apart and appeared to weep. So I kind of thought that was interesting. They would like go off on their own, but maybe when they're together, they're trying to be happy.
Yeah. It's like they didn't want to be sad in each other's company. They didn't want to show the other that they are sad.
Yes.
They really were. So they did it separately.
Yeah. And he can't figure out why they're unhappy. Like, it doesn't make any sense to him. And he's like, they have a nice house. They have food to eat. They have a fire to warm them. They have clothes to wear. I'm not really sure why they're unhappy. One reason he comes up with later is that it seems like they are the kind of in poverty. They didn't have enough food. The boy or girl would often go without so that the older man could eat. This kind of makes him stop. He was taking their food. And this kind of makes the monster stop doing that because he feels bad for them. And he also, I really like this. He helps the boy with the wood in the night. So in the night, he would go out and look for food and he would cut wood and stack it for him. And then they would be like, oh, look, I don't know where all this came from. And this gave the boy more time during the day to do other things. So the first time that he goes out to cut the wood in secret, he says, I remember the first time that I did this. The young woman, when she opened the door in the morning, appeared greatly astonished on seeing a great pile of wood on the outside. She uttered some words in a loud voice and the youth joined her, who also expressed surprise. I observed with pleasure that he did not go to the forest that day, but spent it in repairing the cottage and cultivating the garden. I just thought that was kind of a cute little paragraph.
And especially since he went from taking their food to being like, I'm not going to take their food. Instead, I'm going to try to help them in some way. Not only that, he found his own food out in the forest. Yes.
So at this point, he recognizes that they're speaking to each other, but he can't figure out what their language means. And he's starting to figure out names for things and names of the people. He learns the names of the people that are in the cottage. Some words he recognizes, but he doesn't understand. So there's words for things he understands, but then there's words like good, dearest, unhappy that he hasn't figured out yet. I guess they're not like physical objects that he can pin on. He spends the whole winter here feeling basically the same emotions that the cottagers are feeling. He's just kind of on their roller coaster, right? The boy's name is Felix, and he seems to be the saddest of all of them, but he's always doing kind things for his sister. He brings her flowers. He clears the snow. And sometimes he goes and helps like a farmer that's nearby. He also notices the boy reading and realizes that he wants to learn how to read himself. It says, although I eagerly long to discover myself to the cottagers, so he wants to tell them he's there, I ought not to make the attempt until I had first become the master of their language, which knowledge might enable me to make them overlook the deformity of my figure. For with this, also the contrast perpetually presented to my eyes had made me acquainted. So I think he's constantly trying to figure out ways that like he can overcome this monstrous deformity that he has. Like, what can make them like me? Maybe if I learn their language, I'll be able to talk to them and they won't be afraid of me. And I like this too. Since he'd been watching the cottagers, he knew what people were supposed to look like. Then he sees a reflection of himself. And I think he understands like why people are so, you know, he's like, oh, this is what you're supposed to look like. This is what I look like. This is difficult. He says, at first I started back, unable to believe it was indeed I who was reflected in the mirror. And when I became fully convinced that I was in reality the monster that I am, I was filled with the bitterest sensations of despondence and mortification. Alas, I did not entirely know the fatal effects of this miserable deformity. I mean, you know, I've talked about this on the podcast like a year ago. I had a allergic reaction to something and like, see how I felt when I would look in the mirror. I'd be like, oh my gosh. And I kept thinking to my husband, he was being so nice to me. And then I'd look at myself in the mirror and be like, why is he being so nice to me? I look awful. And I was just telling somebody this week, like, if you want to feel beautiful, just have something like that happen to you. And then you're like,
I have an allergic reaction. Like, a really bad one. I've had major facial deformity and then come back from that.
And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, if I could just look how I normally look. And what's funny is like David kept saying, there's people that look like this. And there are. And I mean, not, you know what I mean? Like there's people that have deformities on their face and like,
yeah,
they've heard of people who are burnt and then they have to like figure out how to cope with it because.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I felt really bad being so vain, and I didn't think I was vain, but I am.
And you saying that, it actually makes me think about, you know, the story of Stephanie Nielsen, who was burned over what, like 90% of her body or something like that. And she is beautiful. She was physically beautiful before this happened. Like she had a beautiful face. She was a beautiful woman. Obviously, like all this burning, it changed her completely. You know, they had to do all kinds of what is it called? Skin grafts, and to save her life and everything. And I read her book and she talked about seeing herself for the first time in the mirror. And like the doctors knew it was going to be really hard. And it was quite a while. I think it was a couple months after her surgery and, you know, lots of healing before she looked in the mirror. And she was horrified. Like she was absolutely horrified. And then the next thing that she was really scared about was letting her kids see her.
Yeah.
Because she had several children and she was really scared to have them see her. But she still lives with it. She's a hero. Like she has learned to deal with it and just be and do the best that she can, and her children. In fact, I was actually just came across something with her and her kids the other day because they're all like grown up and big and on missions and stuff. It's incredible, but it'd be a hard thing.
I was worried about, because I had to fly home on the airplane. I was worried about what Presley was going to think when I got off the airplane. But then, well, first I was worried they wouldn't let me on the airplane because I didn't look like my picture. The TSA lady was like, oh, it's not as bad as you think. Well, then the next day after, it got way worse. But it's like, poor Presley. She's probably like, what happened to my mom? But at least it was temporary. Like, I can just be so grateful for that. So, yeah, he sees himself. He sees a reflection of himself. And he's like, oh, my. I see the problem. So during the day, he watches the people and he sleeps during the day. And then at night, he gathers food and fuel for the cottage. And he also does some of their work. So we talked about that earlier. And he's still, again, wondering why they're so miserable and sad. He wonders if there's something he could do to make them happy. It says, I formed in my imagination 1,000 pictures of presenting myself to them and their reception of me. I imagined that they would be disgusted until by my gentle demeanor and conciliating words, I should first win their favor and afterwards their love. Like I said, he's constantly trying to figure out how he can like get them to like him despite what he looks like. And so he wants to reveal himself to them, but he needs to keep working on their language. And then spring comes, and that is chapter 12.
Yes.
Roman numerals.
You can. I know they confused me for such a long time. And then I started teaching them to my kids. And so now it's sort of second nature. So it's just like exposure, exposure, exposure.
Well, I understand it. It's just like glancing at it, I kind of have to think. I thought it was kind of a fascinating concept to learn in elementary school.
Yes, for sure. Oh. So we're going to jump into chapters 13 and 14. So his observations of the family continue. And he just keeps saying they're just so sad and they're so melancholy. They'd have a few minutes where they're happy and then they're not happy anymore. And then one day, this beautiful woman shows up at their door, and the monster just refers to her as an Arabian woman. So Felix and Agatha both, it seems like they know her, and Felix is especially happy to see her. And it says that sadness is replaced with joy. And so it's not like their situation has really changed. It's like they're still working and laboring hard, but they're now happy. And it does become very apparent that the woman does not speak their language. And so over the next few months, they are teaching her French. And so he kind of takes advantage of that. And he starts learning their language at the same time, because they're teaching it to somebody who not only doesn't speak French, she speaks Arabian. Well, Turkish is, I'm pretty sure, what she would be speaking just based on. But that's like such a different language. You know, there's almost nothing similar that I know of.
What country? Okay, so they're French, but they don't live in France. What country?
They're in Germany right now.
Germany. Okay.
Yes, because they were ostracized. They were kicked out. They were exiled. Oh, and also her name is Sophie, is how I'm going to say it. And it says, she and I improved rapidly in the knowledge of language so that in 2 months, I began to comprehend most of the words uttered by my protectors. So he's like, we got better. Of course, they had no idea I was getting better. But also at the same time, it sounds like Felix was using a certain book by a man named Comte de Volney called The Ruins of Empires. And I actually looked it up, and it's considered an essay, but it is a book. Just his observations about history, about countries, about conquering and all these things. And so in that way, the monster is able to also learn about history and this concept of other countries and sort of the nature of man and their desire to conquer people. It really strikes him. It says, these wonderful narrations inspired me with strange feelings. Was man indeed at once so powerful, so virtuous and magnificent, yet so vicious and base? So he's learning a lot about mankind, and that like what he's seeing in the cottage is one very small aspect of mankind, but there's really a huge world out there and a whole array of attitudes and actions. So he also finds that men must, according to this book, they must meet certain qualifications to be acceptable. And he realizes that he does not. And it says that I learned that the possessions most esteemed by your fellow creatures were high and unsullied descent united with riches. It's all about your name and it's all about your money, which is 100% true right here in the city where I live. Unfortunately. Yes. Even today in 2023.
That's sad.
Anyway, it was sad, but it's true. A man might be respected with only one of these advantages. So he's like, you could get away with it if you had a decent family name, decent heritage, or maybe you don't have a family name, but you have wealth. So you'll be respected. But if you don't have either of those things, he was considered, except in very rare instances, as a vagabond and a slave. And so the monster's like, what was I? He's like, I don't even know where I came from. I don't even know who created me. So no one has claimed me. And so he just realizes how extremely deprived he is. And in a way, all of this learning, we usually say learning is so beneficial. For him, it was not. It was the opposite, because he learned how kind of badly he did have it, because he also learns about families and about how there's babies and they grow up to be men or women, and about fathers and mothers and these family groups. And he's like, I don't have any of that. So like, where does that put me? He's kind of the first one to call himself a monster. He also, in this time, he learns the origin story of this family, and they are the De Lacy family. I'm sure that's not how you say it in French, but what it comes about is that they actually came to their misfortune because of Safi's father. Okay. So he was a Turk living in Paris. He was probably some high government position or something, but the Parisian government didn't like him. They found him obnoxious and a nuisance. So they imprisoned him and they were going to execute him. And really what it came down to, he hadn't really done anything wrong, except maybe he was annoying. That's no grounds to kill somebody. It really came down to his religion and his, you know, country of origin. He was Turkish and he was a Muslim. So Felix had actually been at the trial of Safi's father, and he was like horrified. These people were going to put him to death on just the grounds of his religion and where he was from. And so he promised that he would break him out of prison. And in the course of like figuring out this whole plan and everything, he actually meets the Turk's daughter, who is Safi, and her father can immediately see that there's like some chemistry there. And so he is actually like, listen, you break me out of here, you can marry my daughter. And Felix is like, well, that's not why I'm going to break you out. Like, I'll turn you down, but like, you know. So as an honorable man, he turned down the offer, but he really did like Safi. And also we find out that Safi, she is a Christian. Her mother was a Christian and still married her father. Well, her father still married her. And then had little Safi, and she raised her as a Christian, taught her all the Christian tenets. And so it was very just enticing to Safi to marry a Christian man. And as she said, live in a country that was not oppressive to women. Like, she didn't want to go back to Turkey. She didn't want to go to any Islamic country because the women were very oppressed and she didn't want that. So Felix is able to help the Turk escape, and they're making their way to Italy, and they get there. But the Parisian government has found out about the escape and who was behind it. And so because Felix is not there, they imprison his father and his sister. Felix finds out about this. So he zooms back to Paris, thinking if he turns himself in, that they'll release his father and sister. No such luck. They all just like suffer in prison for 5 months. And when they get out, I feel like there's a little more to it, but basically they've lost all their property because they really were quite wealthy before. They had a lot of means, but they lost all their property, all their possessions, and they were exiled from the country. They were kicked out. And so they were able to find this little cottage in Germany to live at. Okay. So while all that is going on, the Turk, he had found out about it, and he like leaves, he escapes. He decides to head out from Italy, takes his daughter with him. She finds out what happened to Felix and his family, and she wants to go help them. But her dad is ready to board a ship and go back to Turkey. So she's like, well, peace out. I mean, she sneaks away and she's able to, well, she came across some papers that her dad had. So she's able to find out exactly where Felix and his family are in Germany. And it's quite the journey that she takes, but somehow she gets there and shows up at their front porch. And she does bring some money with them to help relieve some of their struggle and suffering. But that's chapter 13 and 14.
The story that's behind the story. The cottagers, yeah, and their sadness.
Exactly. Their little origin story. And that, so that's really why they were sad. They had lost all of their comfort and all their money. And, you know, they probably didn't totally know how to fend for themselves if they were wealthy before. And so they're having to figure all that out. And it's really, it's a struggle. And they had to leave all their friends and their family and everything else. They had to leave their country. And Felix is mourning the loss of Sophie. He didn't think he would ever see her again. So he was sad.
Yeah, and he's probably sad too because he feels like it's his fault.
Yeah, definitely. And also he was betrayed. Like there's a lot happening here. So
yeah. I know. I feel like this story is very detailed. Like
very.
We get a very detailed story of what happened to the monster, and then we get this detailed story of the people that he's watching. And you know, even like I said, I was working on our first episode today and I was like, we really found out a lot about the guy who's telling the story in the beginning, but we haven't really heard much about him for a while. So anyways,
just kind
of interesting. Today I was told Audrey that we were doing this and she goes, you know, that book was written from a short story. I was like, yeah. And I was like, you should listen to our episode. She's like, no. She goes, would you listen to your mom's podcast? I said, probably. She's like, you're just saying that. So anyways, she was not gonna listen, but I asked her where she learned that. She's like, I don't know.
She's just random trivia. She knows.
She does have random trivia. So yeah, it's quite funny. So we're on chapter 15 and 16. So one night while he's out gathering food, he finds a, I love this word, portmanteau, maybe?
Yeah.
Which is a suitcase that has a few articles of clothing and some books in it. And so he takes these books home. Now, I thought this was a little, like, I like that you looked up that one book. I mean, to me, the stuff about the books was, like, very deep and confusing. But I did notice that there's footnotes in the back of my book. Mm. And so you can go and read, and it'll tell you about the book that it mentions. And, like, what?
Okay.
You have footnotes in the back of yours?
Not in the back. There's a couple of footnotes as we go along, but nothing about the books. Two of them I am familiar with. I was not familiar with The Sorrows of Werther.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. That anyway, so he finds these books. One thing it says in the back, in the footnotes, or like they're not footnotes, I don't know, end notes maybe? Yes, they're called end notes. One of the things it said is that all of these are books that Mary Shelley had read the previous year.
So she's like, oh, that's cool. She's like, I'm going to talk about these in my book.
Yeah, just bringing them back. So The Sorrows of Young Werther talks about how she brings in the monster's expressiveness and passion from that book that were, there was like a big dramatic suicide in that book. And so that's kind of where she gets that. He says, as I read, however, I applied much personally to my own feelings and condition. I found myself similar, yet at the same time, strangely unlike to the beings concerning whom I read. And to whose conversation I was a listener. I sympathized with and partly understood them, but I was unformed in mind. I was dependent on none and related to none. The path of my departure was free. And so this takes me back to another end note. This is by her husband's, the path of my departure was free was from her husband's poem, Mutability. And it says, Victor's creation has discovered for himself the opportunities for change and growth in his life, but mourns his lack of guidance, sympathy, and support. So that's what that all means. He says, my person was hideous and my stature gigantic. What did this mean? Who was I? What was I? Whence did I come? What was my destination? These questions continually recurred, but I was unable to solve them. And I kind of thought that was interesting. The thoughts, like, that's kind of how people are. The big questions in life. Who am I? Where did I come from? Yeah. Where am I going? Why are we here?
And how much more confusing for him because he has been left to his own devices and he doesn't know where his creator is.
Yeah, there's no parents to like guide him or help him figure this stuff out. He's trying to figure this out on his own. And first he has to figure out how to understand language and he has a lot to learn. So the next book that he is the Plutarch's Lives. And he says that Plutarch taught him high thoughts. He elevated me above the wretched sphere of my own reflections to admire and love the heroes of past ages. So I think that's also a history.
It is. It's also very much philosophy. Plutarch took lives of people and really analyzed to help us learn about humans and the condition.
So this is interesting. And I'm sure English majors would like dive deeper into this stuff than I'm capable of. And my sister told me that she was an English major. She read it in college. So mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of fun. The other interesting thing is he calls the cottagers protectors. I thought that was kind of cool. I mean, they are protecting him. Basically, they're keeping him safe, even though they don't know it. He didn't know where he came from. He didn't know who his creator was until he found some papers. He had some papers, actually. He'd found them before, hidden in Frankenstein's coat. But now he can read them.
That he grabbed as he was leaving.
Yeah. Yes. And now he can read them. Mm-hmm. Yes. The coat that he grabbed, right? So he took it with him. And he didn't know what all of it was. But now that he can read where he came from. What the papers were was a journal of the 4 months before the monster's creation. Yeah. And so, this is another interesting thing. So he is kind of compared to Adam, who was like put on the earth, although Adam did have guidance, the monster has no guidance. So there's a little section in there where it talks about that.
Because that's what Paradise Lost is about.
Yes.
It's fleshing out the Adam and Eve story. But you're right. I think that he kind of realizes even more. He's like, even Adam had a creator that he knew about, even though he was like the first man. So he was like essentially alone, as far as we know, but he knew who his creator was.
Yeah, and he says, I considered Satan as the fitter emblem of my condition. For often like him, when I viewed the bliss of my protectors, the bitter gall of envy rose within me. So he's kind of thinking of himself more like Satan than Adam. He's reading the papers and he says, I sickened as I read. Hateful day when I received life, I exclaimed in agony, accursed creator, why did you form a monster so hideous that even you turned from me in disgust? God in pity made man beautiful and alluring after his own image, but my form is a filthy type of yours, more horrid even from the very resemblance Satan had his companions, fellow devils, to admire and encourage him, but I am solitary and abhorred. Yeah, the language in this book is incredible. You know, he kind of goes back and forth between thinking, I think the cottagers will like me. And then he's like, I don't know if they're going to like me because I look so awful. But at this point, he's thinking that they will like him when they find out that he is like them in that he's kind and he's trying to help them and that they'll overlook his deformity. And he decides not to worry about it, but he's still going to wait a few more months before he lets them know he's there. The cottagers seem happier since Safi got there and the monster is feeling better all the time unless he looks at himself in a reflection in the water. Or he tries to make himself feel better by doing certain things. And then winter comes and he's paying more attention to the cottagers and he wants them to get to know him. He comes up with this plan to introduce himself when the old blind man is alone, which makes so much sense, right? He says later that he kind of messed it up, and he should have done it differently. He's alone. Everybody has left. And so he decides he's going to go talk to him. At first, his limbs won't work. And then he is able to get up and he goes and knocks on the door and the man answers. The monster tells him that he's a traveler looking for rest. And when he talks, the man thinks that he's French because he talks like them. The monster, he said he was educated by a French family. And then the man asks, are they Germans? No, they are French. But let us change the subject. I am an unfortunate and deserted creature. I look around and I have no relation or friend upon earth. These amiable people to whom I go have never seen me and know little of me. I am full of fears, for if I fail there, I am an outcast in the world forever. And I kind of like this back and forth with him because he's like, they kind of live close to here.
And you can kind of, after this back and forth, you can kind of understand their reaction later because probably the father does relay their whole conversation to them. It would be pretty creepy.
I think the creepy part is like he's been there watching.
Exactly.
That's, I don't know. Anyway, so he kind of goes back and forth like, where do these friends reside? Near this spot. The old man paused. Anyways, it's just kind of funny how he goes back and forth. And the monster tells him that he trusts that the old man can help him. And the old man, he kind of tells him, well, we've also been condemned. We kind of understand your situation and we're innocent. The man finally asks who the friends are and he pauses. Then he begins to sob And just then he hears the others coming, and the monster has to tell him really quickly that it is them. After they come in, they scream? Maybe that is what I... Yes, yeah. I'm going to read this. Who can describe their horror and consternation on beholding me? Agatha fainted, and Safi, unable to attend to her friend, rushed out of the cottage. Felix darted forward and with supernatural force tore me from his father, to whose knees I clung in a transport of fury. He dashed me to the ground and struck me violently with a stick. I could have torn him limb from limb as the lion rends the antelope, but my heart sunk within me as with bitter sickness, and I refrained. I saw him on the point of repeating his blow when, overcome by pain and anguish, I quitted the cottage and, in the general tumult, escaped unperceived to my hovel. After that happens, then he starts feeling all this anger and rage. That night, he goes for a walk in the woods, then declares war against this person who created him, realizing that there's nobody in the world that's going to help him. I kind of think of people that commit horrible, horrible crimes. Is this what they feel? Like they have this, maybe they know they have this problem, but they're like, there's nobody that can help me.
I would think so. I mean, I don't know. I was thinking about this a lot, and I'm like, okay, what is the message that she's really trying to tell us? And maybe I'm way off. I couldn't help but think through all of this about kids who are just like abandoned by their parents. Whether, I mean, maybe they still live in the same house with them, but their parents pay no attention to them whatsoever. Our first attachments are made in the first 5 years of life. And if we don't have that, if we don't have anybody to attach to, we're just kind of floating going, what's wrong with me? What is so wrong with me that my parents rejected me? Because that's really what he's feeling. He's like, what is wrong with me that I don't even know who my creator is? He's nowhere around. And I don't have attachment to anything. There's no permanence. There's nothing to teach me anything. I'm having to learn vicariously through this Arabian lady who's learning French. You know, that's the way I'm learning language, because there's nobody in my life that cares enough to teach me. And so that really is kind of the psychology of children too, is that they're like, well, what's wrong with me that my parents aren't around and they don't care to teach me. They don't care to be with me and to spend that precious time with me and to raise me.
Yeah, I'm taking a parenting class right now, and I am loving it.
Oh,
just loving it. And it's made me think, like, look at how I'm acting to my kids totally different.
Yeah.
And the parenting class is so interesting because it's not about, they've said this, it's not about quick fixes. It's not about tips. It's about your mindset as a parent. Yeah, it's made me think about what does, especially Presley, because she's little, and everybody else, same thing with the other kids too, though, is like, what do they think when I'm with them? Do they think that they're important, or do they think that I don't have time for them, or I'm always mad at them? Yeah. Or
believe it or not, Frankenstein can be a bit of a parenting book for sure. But really, it can also be parents who are so busy, so consumed with all of their own things, that what happens to the kids? They fall. Sure, like somebody can say, oh, I'm a stay-at-home mom. Are you there with your kids? Are you there? Like, are you so involved in your own hobbies and your own things that it has nothing to do with the kids?
I think, like, it's easy to do. So let's see, where are we at? So he declares war against whoever created him, realizing that nobody's going to help him. He's looking back at the situation where he introduced himself to the cottagers, and he's wondering if he reacted too quickly in the cottage. It had been going well with the old man. And so I think he realizes that maybe he should have talked to the old man more times. And then seen, and then had the people see. So like the old man could have gotten more of a connection to him before they were introduced to him. So he'd run off into the woods. And then I think it's probably the next day, he decides that he's going to return to the cottage and try again. Cause he's like, it really did go well. I think I could salvage this. But when he goes back, they're all gone. And he sees Felix outside with a man. Felix says, we can't ever come back here. So they had been renting the cottage, and he's like, the life of my father is in the greatest danger. My wife and my sister will never recover their horror. So he's like, you can have this place. We're leaving. We can't come back here. This upsets the monster so much. So
yes,
he's upset by that they're abandoning him. And then he wants to get revenge. So he basically blows up everything around the cottage, and then he burns it down. And the whole time he's thinking about Frankenstein. And so he decides he's going to go find him. He's going to go wreak havoc on
his revenge.
This is just the beginning. He knew where he had come from because of the papers that he'd found in the coat. So as he's traveling, he's traveling towards Geneva. It's snowing, the rivers are frozen, and he can only travel at night because he doesn't want people to see him and he can't find shelter. So he's just getting more and more angry as he gets closer and closer to Frankenstein's home. And then one day in the spring, he decides he's traveling during the day this time. So the monster saves a girl from the river. So a girl is like running away from somebody. It looks like she's playing with them. And yeah, she runs into the river and goes under. And so he goes to save her. He pulls her out and she's not responding. I'm not really sure if the girl lived or died, but when he's holding her, she's not responding. And then a man comes and like wrestles the girl away from him. He runs off into the woods and the monster follows him. And then when the man sees that the monster is following him, he turns and shoots him. And now he's really mad. His wound hurts. He's feeling rejected again. He faints. And at that point, since he's wounded, he has to spend several weeks in the woods healing. So every day, he says, my daily vows rose for revenge, a deep and deadly revenge, such as would alone compensate for the outrages and anguish I had endured. Eventually, he arrives at Frankenstein's house and he sees a child there and he gets the idea that this child could be his friend. Horrible idea. So he grabs him and then the boy obviously is going to struggle because he's looked so scary. He places his hands around his neck to like try to quiet him. And then just a few seconds, the child is gone. He then realizes that he had killed him. Then at that point, the monster sees the necklace around the little boy's neck. And he thinks that the lady, the picture of the lady on the necklace is lovely. And he's like, at that moment, he realizes that he's never going to have somebody like that in his life. He's never going to have a mother. So he's just, I feel like this is just like a domino. He's getting more and more and more angry as he goes. So he runs off. And then here's where the stories merge. He finds a barn, which he thinks nobody is in. But then he goes in there and Justine is in there. And he realizes that if she woke up, then she would react just like everybody else. I think he wants to be her friend too, right? He's like, she could be my companion after all of his experiences with other people. That's is never going to work. And I think this is funny because she can't give him what he wants, even though she's asleep and has no choice in the matter. Then she's going to be held accountable for this murder. And so he plants the necklace on her and he runs off. And at that point, he realizes nobody's going to be his, he's never going to have a companion, a woman to be with him. That's when he decides, Frankenstein is going to need to create a companion for me. Mm-hmm. I did not know this is where the story was going to go.
Me neither. But it makes sense. He's like, because he doesn't like himself this way. He doesn't like those awful feelings and the awful things that he's doing. And it is really sad because the little boy, who of course was Frankenstein's little brother, he had thought, well, he's probably young enough that he hasn't been able to form enough prejudice. Maybe he won't think I'm so monstrous. And so maybe he'll like me. Maybe I'll finally find somebody that will like me. And so it's very tragic. The entire thing is so very sad. He needs companionship, obviously. We all do. So chapter 17, he's in the mountains. So he's come across Frankenstein. And he tells him, you need to create a female for me. And he dives into this concept of why he wants a female. He says, I demand it of you as a right, which you must not refuse to concede. You know, I think he's built up so much anger and this need for vengeance. And now he's like, look, you've gotten me to this point. You need to get me out of this. You owe me this. He's like, you can't refuse me. And Frankenstein says, I do refuse it. I'm not going to create somebody else like you. Because if there's two of you, you know, look what you've done so far. There's two of you, you're going to like destroy the world. But the monster says, I am content to reason with you. I am malicious because I am miserable. Am I not shunned and hated by all mankind? You, my creator, would tear me to pieces in triumph. Remember that. And tell me why I should pity man more than he pities me. And he says, if I cannot inspire love, I will cause fear. He's like, I demand a creature of another sex. But as hideous as myself, the gratification is small, but it is all that I can receive. And he's like, we wouldn't be happy, but we would be content. And he's like, listen, you promised to do this. We'll go off to South America. You'll never see us again. So Frankenstein, he's really hesitant as he tries to like conceptualize what would be the consequences? Because it's sort of like immediately he's like, no. And then he's like, well, maybe. And he's trying to think, what would be the consequences if I did this? Again, like when the monster promises, you'll never see me again. So finally, Frankenstein, I think in his heart too, he kind of feels like maybe he should do this. Maybe he does owe this to the monster. But he says to him, he's like, you know, you say that you're going to go off on your own with this female I'm going to create for you, and you're going to be just fine. But in exile, why do you think that you would be happy? You're still going to be miserable. He's very certain that he'd be lonely. They go back and forth for a while until finally Frankenstein consents to do what the monster asks. And the monster says, okay, well, I'm going to descend upon you as soon as it's done. So I'll be watching you. Frankenstein is very, very distraught. And so he returns to where they're staying, Chamonix or whatever. And then he goes immediately to Geneva. His family is super worried about him. They can tell that something's wrong, but he's not going to divulge anything. He really doesn't feel like he can share anything with them. So as he's making his way back to Chamonix, he says, I wept bitterly and clasping my hands in agony, I exclaimed, oh, stars and clouds and winds, ye are all about to mock me. If you really pity me, crush sensation and memory. Let me become as naught, but if not, depart, depart and leave me in darkness. It's just sort of like his yelling at the heavens and the universe and being like, why? This is horrible. This is like the worst thing that could possibly have happened. So he's back in Geneva, and actually days and weeks go by, and he really finds he can't start. He can't start the project. Like, he's almost physically unable to do it. He kind of feels like he needs to go to England. Like, it's not like he's saying, no, I'm not going to do it. He just keeps procrastinating, really. He says to himself, well, I need to go to England to consult this philosopher there. And also, really, you know, his family's there with him in Geneva. And he's like, I can't work on this with them around. Like, I don't want them to be subjected to this. And so he's kind of trying to find an excuse to go to England. In the meantime, though, he has returned to pretty good health. Overall, besides this extreme stress hanging over his head, he's like doing much better than he had been before. So his father approaches him and he's like, look, you seem to be doing better. And so I just wanted to talk to you about something. He's like, from the time you guys were little, I kind of just assumed that you and Elizabeth were going to get married, but it seems like it's time for that and nothing is happening. And so now I'm worried, like, maybe you feel more like she's a sister to you than somebody you could marry. And he's like, and that's fine. Or maybe you've got somebody and you're feeling guilty because you feel like you owe something to Elizabeth. And Frankenstein is, I think in his mind, he's like, okay, I just haven't thought about this like at all. Just haven't. But he tells his father, he's like, no, like Elizabeth is who I want to marry. Absolutely. He just feels like he can't marry her with this thing hanging over him. He probably feels like it would put her in danger and who knows what it's going to do to him. And so he feels like he can't marry her until this thing is taken care of. So he needs to buy himself some time. And so he does go to England. He's like, it might be months, it might be a year, you know, got to do this thing. But then he gets really stressed out. He's like, wait, if I leave, is the monster going to think that I took off and then he's going to go take vengeance on my family? But then he remembers that the monster said he would follow him wherever he was. I don't think that actually happened in their conversation. So I think she just threw that in there. So then it became, okay, he could leave. And then also Elizabeth and his father had arranged for his friend Henry Clerval to meet up with him and to travel to England. He was like, I don't know if I really want him, but he really does. Like, he's a really great friend and good companion. He says that Henry is just, he's just so alive. He's just soaking everything in as they're traveling from Switzerland to England. And it says he's like born of poetry during their travels and just finds so much joy in everything. And I think it's interesting because I think that Frankenstein can really see and feel the contrast. And it's very telling. There's this one point that they go past the Rhine River in Germany. It says, in one spot, you view rugged hills, ruined castles overlooking tremendous precipices with the dark Rhine rushing beneath. So this kind of very dark, gothic looking, kind of creepy, scary area. And then on the sudden turn of a promontory, flourishing vineyards with green sloping banks and a meandering river and populous towns occupy the scene. I mean, there is this stark contrast both between Henry and Victor in that one is not weighed down with all these terrible things and stress. And so he's lighthearted and happy and loves everything. And Victor is, he's so weighed down. He's so stressed. He's so unhappy. So he's very gloomy. But then also, I think we could look at it and say this is quite symbolic of, you know, sort of his life, what he's looking forward to. It's like, I just got to get rid of this darkness and then I can see the light and there's so much life ahead. So I've got to figure this out. And then I think we get something. I haven't read the rest of the book, so I don't know, but I think that it's foreshadowing because, again, he's talking about his friend Henry, and he says, and where does he now exist? And where does he now exist? Is this gentle and lovely being lost forever? Has this mind so replete with ideas, imaginations, fanciful and magnificent, which formed a world whose existence depended on the life of its creator? Has this mind perished? Does it now only exist in my memory? No, it is not thus. Your form so divinely wrought and beaming with beauty has decayed, but your spirit still visits and consoles your unhappy friend. And he says, pardon this gush of sorrow. These ineffectual words are but a slight tribute to the unexampled worth of Henry, but they soothe my heart, overflowing with the anguish which his remembrance creates. I will proceed with my tale. So I mean, he's telling us that Henry dies. I don't know when, but it's sounding like it's quite prematurely. That's really where this section ends, this chapter ends, except that they do arrive in London. They get to England and they arrive in London. Heavy, kind of dark stuff.
You can kind of put yourself in his place, like when something dark and something's hanging over you that you just feel like you can't move. I mean, obviously, I haven't had this degree. But is it ever going to be okay? Am I going to be able to get past this? Once I've gone through this, am I ever going to be the same?
Yeah, totally.
And not knowing what's coming, right?
Yeah. And how do you even get out? Like, what is there a way out? What is the way out? Not sure.
Which one do I do?
Yeah.
I just kept thinking like, I don't know. There's got to be a way to destroy him.
Which has got to be somewhat of a moral dilemma as well, because he's like, I created him. Do I have the right to destroy him?
Yeah. And here's my question too, because it talks about how he is like stronger than a human. He's bigger than a human. He doesn't hurt things don't hurt him as much. Did he create him with that in mind? Or is that just how it happened? Like, was he trying to create a superhuman?
I don't know. I mean, I do remember from the first couple chapters, he just talked about making everything larger just because it was easier to work with that way. Just because minuscule parts in a normal sized human being would be so very difficult and cumbersome. Even so, was it accidental that he was this like superhuman? Was he thinking he was just making like an extra tall, large human? Did he realize that he was going to be like so strong and so dangerous, kind of undefeatable?
Yeah, think about so like a Goliath.
Yeah, Goliath. I mean, I also kind of think of the Hulk a little bit. I don't think he was supposed to be quite that big, but.
And it's funny how this story kind of, you can see it in other stories.
Yeah, definitely used as sort of a blueprint for.
Yeah. So do you think he's going to, I didn't ever know there was a female. So maybe he doesn't ever get to make it. I don't know. It'll be interesting to read the end.
So here's my prediction, and it's probably very dark and awful, but my prediction is that he failed in making the female. And so Frankenstein goes and like kills everybody who's dear to him.
That's why what happens.
That's kind of what I'm wondering.
Because I kind of know what's going to happen in that respect. Well, yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know what happens with Monster, but you're probably right. That's probably why the end goes the way it does. Mm-hmm. It must be a sad ending.
Well, I mean, just judging by the way that Frankenstein is with our, what is his name? The sailor? The guy who starts the story?
Wasn't it like Robert?
Is it Walton?
Robert Walton?
Yeah.
Who even knows who's telling the story?
Robert Walton, yes.
So interesting. And I just feel so accomplished. We're almost done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good stuff. So
it feels really good to, we're getting ready. We're going to do a 1-year anniversary podcast after the next one, right? So in 2 weeks. And I was thinking about it and I was like, I went back and counted. We've read 11 classics in 2023. I probably have read 11 classics maybe in my whole life. So it's pretty good.
Doubled the number. That's right. Awesome.
I mean.
So cool.
Anyways.
And not only that, like, you know these really well. That's pretty cool, actually.
I totally do. Enough to fool all you listeners.
I think it is awesome. So.
I'm excited to tell you what I read.
Yeah, go for it.
This is exciting. It's called The Paris Daughter by Kristen Harmel.
Oh, and I've heard of that. Okay.
She wrote the book of Lost Names, I think it was.
Okay.
And I read that, but I liked this one better. It was excellent. The ending was a little bit cheesy. Mm. Not cheesy, like really, just the last, like, I don't know, 5% of it. So anyways, up until then, it was great. It was
okay. Great.
But it's this, an American girl who marries a, I think he's a French artist. And during World War II, it's a World War II book. He's like, has some weird political views, right? And so he gets in trouble and he like throws her under the bus right before he's tortured and dies. Like at the very, it's the very beginning of the book. And he's like, yeah, she thinks the same things and she's involved in this too. And she totally wasn't. And so she basically has to run off and leave her daughter with her friend. She leaves and she feels horrible about having to leave her daughter. And then the friend is mad at her for leaving her. She just kind of judges her. Like, how could she? How could she have left her? But
yeah,
she had to. The person who got her the paperwork to leave didn't get paperwork for the little girl, and she had to leave or they were going to kill her.
Oh, wow.
So it was very good. I really liked it.
Yeah, I've seen that one talked about. And I haven't read the Book of Lost Names either, so there's two that I need to do.
Yeah, I liked that one, but I thought this one was better. I was more engaged, I guess. Yeah, it was.
Wait, have I read the Book of Lost Names? No, I haven't. I don't think so. I told you about the book about the Armenian genocide, right? The Sandcastle Girls. And so I thought, well, that one was really good. So I'm going to try another book by the same author that I had also seen recommended. Well, there was sort of like mixed reviews on it. It's called The Hour of the Witch. And so it's about just the crazy witch craze in the 1600s. Now, we always hear about the Salem witch trials, but it was happening everywhere. And not just the 1600s too, but this is Boston during that time. The biggest issue that I have with it is a good book. It's well written. It moves along really well. Good characters. Very much gets you into that context of Puritans and their speech and all their crazy superstitions. The narrator, I'm like, okay, if this lady can narrate, I think anybody should be paid to narrate. It's pretty bad. I'm sorry. Sorry to be mean to somebody who's a narrator. But I just, there's only been a couple of narrators I've come across in how many audiobooks have I listened? I don't even know. Hundreds. And there's only been a couple that I've come across. I'm like, I'm going to make it through because I want to hear what's going on with this book. But holy moly, like, why are you a narrator?
Like back in the day when they just read us the book instead of now before they act it and like,
Yeah, like really dramatize it and stuff. Man, I don't know if I've listened to any like that. That sounds horrible. I'm not done with it just because I'm having a hard. There's 14 hours long and I'm only into it a few hours and I'm not sure if I'm going to finish just because I can't. I'm having such a hard time.
Several narrators. Is it just?
Well, that's what it says, but the main narrator is doing it the whole time. And then every once in a while, you'll have another voice come in to read like this brief sentence or two of a court record.
Julia Whalen is listed, and she's a really awesome narrator. Yes. And then Kirby Hayborn.
I know. I haven't actually heard him yet. I'm 4 hours in. I haven't heard him yet. But yeah. All the people who read the court records are way better than the main narrator. Yeah.
That's sad.
But it's basically about this lady who's trying to get a divorce from her husband in puritanical Boston, Massachusetts. That's fun because he's horribly abusive.
That was one I wanted to read. I think we talked about it last week. And I guess if you have time to read a paper book, read up the paper book.
I would say, try to read it. I don't have time. So, and I'm going to get through it, but I've only got a few. How many more days do I have? 6 days, which wouldn't be a problem normally, but holy moly.
Is her voice just like grating?
It's very monotone. And it's like, I don't really even know how to describe it. It's just like a very amateur reader. I mean, it's like somebody, you can tell they never read to their kids and they pick up a book and start reading to kids. And you're like, okay, like the kids need some variety in your tone. Everybody listening to you, they need to hear something different, not just.
Yeah.
It's like somebody who's not comfortable with reading, really reading aloud is what it sounds like.
Weird. I'll have to listen to the sample.
Yeah, maybe just listen to the sample and tell me if you can describe it better than what I just did, because I didn't do a good job. It's just,
Well, I will. I'll listen to it.
So next week we'll do the end of Frankenstein. So chapters 19 to, I think there's 24 chapters. There's about 60 pages left, I think. That'll be fun. And then after that, we're going to do a book that I loved as a child called All of a Kind Family by Sydney Taylor.
And I'm so excited for that.
It's so delightful. It'll be around Thanksgiving-ish time. So it'll be like a fun family book. Oh, yeah, I just love perfect. It. We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, chapters 19 through 24. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.